You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Claire Pooley is my guest. She's the author of the memoir, The Sober Diaries, How One Woman Stopped Drinking and Started Living, and two novels, The Authenticity Project and her new book, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. Claire Pooley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for writing such a delightful and entertaining book. It's so great. I just love it. Claire Pooley, in one of your author bios that I read, it said that you had a pet hedgehog. And I have to know more about this. Is this true? You had a pet hedgehog?
Sadly, RIP. So he's very sadly died during lockdown. But we did have a pet African pygmy hedgehog who belonged to my eldest daughter, and he was very cute. He was sort of, you know, he was a bit prickly sometimes, but but aren't we all?
Well, I mean, what is the life expectancy of a hedgehog?
About six to eight years, an African pygmy hedgehog. Ours died a little prematurely, which was very sad.
I'm sorry to hear that. I don't want to bring up sad memories.
But it's okay. We're getting over it.
You're the first person I've met that's ever had a hedgehog of any kind. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's a thing where you guys come from. In that strange country that you come from, the people have hedgehogs, but
no, it's not. It's quite unusual over here as well, actually. But you know, we like to we like to be a little bit unusual.
You spent several years in advertising before you became an author. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, nearly 20 years, actually, long time. So you know, I joined advertising in the early 90s when you know it was still. Slightly reminiscent of the Mad Men era back then.
Yeah, I bet. Was there any resistance to you getting into advertising due to being a woman, or was that totally open?
It was very male dominated then, actually. And you know, there were a few women around, but often at the junior levels, there weren't very many at all at the sort of senior levels back then. And actually, even by the time I left, so I left advertising when I was nearly 40, and I was one of the oldest women in the agency at that point, which was extraordinary, really.
How did you get into that?
Into advertising? Well, you know, I was just one of those kids that used to watch TV and enjoy the ads more than the programs. You know? So it was just something that I was always fascinated by. And, I just thought it would be a really good, fun industry. And it was for a very long time. It was great fun. But it's a lot more serious as a business now, I think, than it was back then.
Yeah. Did you just had a mind for selling things, I guess, or coming up with interesting ways to sell them?
I think what I loved is the creativity of it. I mean, in the back then, the ads were often more creative than the programs that surrounded them, and you know, I loved the variety and the creativity and different ways of making people remember things. You know, all those little jingles and the sort of strap lines and, you know, it was great fun.
And then you started blogging. Were you blogging? I mean, as a advertising person, you must have done a lot of writing, but not the same kind of writing.
Well, you know, I mean, for a long time, I didn't write much apart from PowerPoint presentations. You know, I'd always wanted to write a novel, but I was working too hard, playing too hard. I had three kids, pets, you know, everything. It was a bit of a crazy time for a while. So you know, I never got round to writing the novel I'd always wanted to write. And then I only really started writing properly about 7 years ago when I started blogging, and I started blogging as a means of therapy when I quit drinking.
Well, you must be a natural at it for some reason, but when you were younger, you know, before you got into advertising, had you considered being a novelist? I mean, did you have stories rattling around in your head that you wanted to tell?
Yeah, I mean, if you'd asked me when I was a teenager what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have told you I wanted to be a novelist. I mean, that was my absolute dream. I just didn't think I'd ever be able to do it. So, but yeah. it was always my ambition because I've always loved reading. I love reading. I love writing. I just didn't get around to it till quite recently. So I had my first novel published when I was 50. It's very much a second act for me.
Well, you know, I think the same is true with Edgar Rice Burroughs, the man who created Tarzan, and he wrote, you know, something like 80 or 90 novels in his lifetime.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, yeah.
And, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to fit that many in, by the way.
Well, you know, his were a different type of novel, but and so had you always been a journal, you know, keeper, a diarist in your
life? When I was younger, I wrote a diary, and that's why when I realized that I was drinking way too much and I had to quit, and I was too ashamed of the sort of situation I found myself in to get professional help, which is probably what I should have done. And instead, what I thought I'd do is go back to writing a diary. But a diary sort of felt a bit old fashioned, by this stage. So 2015, this was. So instead of writing a diary, I started a blog instead. But it was very much just my own form of therapy. I didn't really expect anyone to read it. It was, and I wrote under a pseudonym because I was way too embarrassed about the idea that anyone might know what I was writing about. So writing became my therapy as a way of dealing with addiction.
Now, do you think that drink entered your life because the world of advertising? I mean, like, get back to Mad Men. I mean, we always see them drinking. They're constantly drinking all day long.
Yes, partly. I mean, we had a bar in the office, so a lot of work, went on in the bar over drinks at the end of the day. And I had a huge expense account, and I was expected to use it taking clients out for lunch, for dinner, more drinks. So yes, it was partly that, and it was partly just the fact that, you know, I'd get home at the end of the day, and I'd want to I'd get the kids in bed, and I'd want to find some way of switching off and sort of, changing the dial from work time to me time. And alcohol was my way of doing that. But it all, I eventually got slightly out of control. So what was, started off as one large glass at the end of the day became two, became three, and eventually a whole bottle of wine a day.
And are you the kind of person that would, in the way that your character in the Authenticity Project has kind of lied to yourself about, oh, I could just handle, I'll just have one and it'll be fine?
I mean, Hazard in the Authenticity Project was very much based on me. So his thought process of, why he quit, and then how he dealt with it. And the way he justified to himself having a drink after having been dry for some time was exactly the thought processes that I'd been through myself. So yes, I think I was able to write his character quite accurately.
Well, you are able to write all your characters very accurately, which is one of the delights in your books. And both of your novels have a lot of characters, and they all have their own points of view. And I really loved the Authenticity Project, but I find that your second book, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting, your second novel, is much better. Not that I didn't love the first one, but I think this one is really shows a whole other thing. I mean, and is that something that I don't know? I don't want to make it sound like I didn't like your first book, but your second book is so much better.
No, but I'm really pleased you said that, because a novelist's fear is always that, that they're just a one book wonder, and that, the second novel is always going to be compared unfavorably. And I think everyone is always really nervous. They're going to read lots of reviews that said, oh, I like this, but it wasn't as good as the last one. And actually I've had, you know, almost the opposite response, as you've said. So I couldn't be more thrilled, really.
Well, it seems to me, and you can definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a certain framework that you used in your first novel that you use in your second novel. I mean, they're both completely very different stories, but the manner, the frame on which the stories are hung is very similar. You have a group of characters, you have points of view in each chapter, you have similar central characters. Was that a conscious thing, or?
Yes, it was, really. I mean, it's as you say, the stories are very different and the characters are very different, but the structure and the style and the feel of the novels is very similar. So, you know, I think my advertising background means that I really like short chapters. So I tend to write short chapters, and I love shifting perspective between characters. So with both of them, I have a cast of characters. So there are six characters in the Authenticity Project and five in Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. And the story shifts from one character's perspective to another. And the reason I love playing with that is because I just love the fact that we all make assumptions about each other all the time. And so often those assumptions are completely wrong. And I love the way that one character can be seen very differently through the eyes of the other characters. And, you know, each of them will make mistakes and their assumptions, but they're often different mistakes. So it allows me to play with all of that, which I find really intriguing.
Both of your novels have a central character who is older than everyone else in the story. And I wonder, do you think that younger generations today have less reverence for their elders than maybe they should? Was that something you wanted to comment about or felt strongly?
Yeah. I love multi-generational stories because I think they're, you know, really magical and exciting things can happen when you get a real mix of ages, nationalities, sexualities. You know, and the great thing about a city like London, where both my novels is set, is that it is such a mélange of different people. So I really wanted to represent that. I personally, and I would say this because I'm the age that I am, but you know, I think that older people have so much life and wisdom to share with the younger generation. But again, I love playing with the perceptions. So I love the fact that Iona is 57 and she thinks she's really young. You know, she feels just the same as she did when she was 20. She's got loads of energy, loads of, enthusiasm for life. She is a fabulous character. And yet the younger characters in the cast, you know, see her as being ancient, you know, and you probably get this as well. You know, and there's a sort of it's extraordinary how my kids, who are teenagers, think that people of my age are dinosaurs. We know very different.
Yes, you look at somebody and think of them as who they are and never who they were. That is, it's hard to picture older people dancing and having long hair. I used to have really long hair, and, you know, or doing all the things that young people are doing. You know, we did them too, and then our parents did them, and our grandparents did them.
Yeah, and I in the you know in the book, Iona's backstory gradually emerges, and it's far more colourful and exciting than anybody else's. You know, so yeah, I'm quite in love with her. Actually, she's a great character.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're chatting this week with Claire Pooley. She's the New York Times bestselling author of The Authenticity Project and her new novel, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting.
So how did you, what is your method? Do you write little biographies of all your characters so that you know how deep their past goes? I mean, do you know everything about them or do they surprise you?
Oh, I'm not that organized, actually. So I tend to, I have an idea of who they are to start with. And then I start writing and I allow them to emerge because I think that's much more exciting. It's more exciting for me. It means that, you know, if I tried to force my characters into a sort of into a hole, into a certain sort of pigeonhole, I think they would feel a bit wooden. You know, I think you have to allow them to develop themselves and to surprise you, because then they become much more three-dimensional and much more interesting. So, you know, to give you an example, Iona, I knew how old she was. I knew what sort of job she did. And I'd started writing her, and I was trying to imagine who her partner was. And I was trying to picture this man that she was married to, and it just didn't fit. And I realized that she wasn't married to a man at all. She was married to a woman. But that wasn't something that I hadn't intended to write, you know, a queer character. It's just what was right for her. You know, she told me that that's who she was. And I do that with all my characters. I start off with a rough idea, but then I allow them to tell me who they want to be, who they want to be married to or not married to, where they want to live, you know, all of those little details. And gradually their backstory emerges. And that's when they start feeling really real, is when you get an idea as to, you know, exactly where they've come from.
So do you go to sleep at night when you're in the middle of writing your novel and think, huh, I wonder what they're going to do tomorrow?
Yeah. And sometimes they really surprise you. So, you know, for anyone who's read The Authenticity Project, there's a twist towards the end of that novel. And, you know, I haven't met anyone yet who saw that big twist coming. And I think the reason they never saw it coming is because I didn't see it coming when I was writing. So I was writing along quite happily, and I suddenly got to this point where I thought, oh my God, one of these characters has been really lying to me. I mean, they'd completely flummoxed me, and I was quite angry with them, actually. I gave them a really sort of, you know, stern talking to. And that twist came out of the blue for me. And I think that's the reason why nobody else has guessed it, because if I'd known it was coming, I would have accidentally dropped clues along the way. But I had no idea. I was completely left field.
Well, and again, you know, your books are not mysteries. There's no murder in any of your stories. But I don't, you know, we don't want to spoil the thrill of discovery. But in The Authenticity Project, did you think about the effect that your twist would have on the other characters in the story?
Well, once I knew it was happening, I did. I then went through each of them thinking, how are they going to react? Because, you know, what was interesting for me is because I'd had a sort of, you know, quite a visceral reaction to it myself, I was able to, you know, imagine how each of the characters might have also felt betrayed and sort of misled. So I don't want to give too much away, but yeah.
I think it's a trait of some of your characters, thinking back on the two novels, that when you first meet them, you don't like them, or there's something about them that is annoying. In fact, even the other people don't like them. And then you come to sort of see the fuller person. Is that something that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually, because when I'm developing a character, I don't start from their strengths. I don't start by thinking, what's this person good at? And what's their sort of, you know, what does everyone love about them? I start by thinking, what does this person struggle with? What do they find really difficult in life? What would they most like to change about themselves? Because I think those are much more interesting questions. And I think somebody's weaknesses are much more interesting than somebody's strengths. So I always start from that point and then work from there. And what I find interesting is that actually it's those, what you discover is it's those weaknesses that make the character unique and human and lovable. And then I think by the end of the story, you do come to love them despite their weaknesses, but often because of their weaknesses, if that makes sense.
Well, your book, Claire Pooley, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting, has a different title over there. Is that right?
Yes, it does. In the UK, it's called The People on Platform 5. So totally different. Same story, exactly the same story. So don't buy them both.
Right. But why did they change the title? Whose idea was it to change the title?
Well, my My publisher, I have fantastic publishers in the UK and in the US, but they just couldn't agree on which was the best title. So in the end, they decided to go with the title they thought was best for each of their individual markets. And I think in the UK, they wanted to focus on the fact that this was a group of people. And in the US, my publisher wanted to really focus on Iona, who is, you know, the lead character. So, yeah, so it was just a difference of market and difference of opinion.
And what about you? How do you think of your book? As the people on Platform 5 or as Iona?
Well, honest, my title was another one altogether. So.
Well, what was your title? Tell us, what was your title?
Well, my original title was The Wisdom of Carriage H, but I understand that in the US you don't have train carriages, so that would have been a problem, because you have train cars, is that right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you know, in the East Coast, people commute via train, you know, if they live in the suburbs of New York, and then they commute into Manhattan. But I don't think train commuting is something that happens on a regular basis here.
So,
we commute in our cars all by ourselves.
it's quite over here. You know, it's commuting by train, by bus, by London Underground is much more common than commuting by car.
Well, do you think that you're that aspect of the story aside, do you think that your novels are inherently British?
Yes and no. I think obviously the setting is very British, and you could say the humor is quite British as well. Just because that's the way I think.
Yeah.
But I think the truths are global. I think the characters and the things they struggle with. So in Iona Iverson's Rules of Commuting, the characters struggle with things like ageism, with anxiety attacks, there's a chap who's sort of really desperately wanting to change his career and is feeling very unfulfilled, and there are people with tricky marriages, and you know, those things are universal. They're not specifically British at all. And even if the commuting experience isn't exactly the same in different countries, I think the impact of getting to know a group of strangers and what might happen next very much is.
And I want to talk a little bit more about your sobriety and how it plays into your writing. I mean, is that something that is still a day-to-day aspect of your life?
Sobriety is, yes. I mean, I haven't had a drink now for over 7 years. And you know what? I don't think I ever could have written a novel if I was still drinking. You know, there's this sort of, you know, there's this, there's, I think a lot of people have this image of the Hemingway style writer who needs to have a bottle of whiskey by the typewriter to sort of, you know, to become creative. But I found quite the opposite. You know, I found that actually when I quit drinking, I suddenly sort of unleashed this creativity that I hadn't felt for a decade. And, you know, and I had a lot more energy. And apart from anything else, I could get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, which I never would have done with a hangover, sure. And write for 3 hours before the kids got out of bed. So, I'm not sure I could have done it while I was still drinking.
Did your decision to become sober, was that driven by just totally from within, or were was your family pressuring you, or how did you come to the decision?
Well, it was mainly me, because I was very good at hiding the fact that I had an issue with drink, and I think my husband had a vague idea, as did my mother, but nobody else did. So nobody, you know, there was no intervention or anything like that. I just realized that it was having a majorly negative impact on my life. So, you know, I couldn't sleep properly. I was anxious all the time. I was very overweight. My whole life was stuck in a rut. And I just felt like I wasn't being a very good mother either. I spent a lot of time sort of, you know, being impatient with the kids and sort of, you know, finding excuses to go and have a drink rather than doing bedtime stories or whatever. So, yeah, it just was having a big negative impact on my life.
And you used writing as a therapy, you were saying, rather than professional help. And how did the writing work? I mean, how did it help you? Did you, when you read it yourself, you would think, oh, that woman is pathetic, she has to stop drinking? I mean, how did it work?
Well, I mean, I wrote every day in this blog, and I just wrote about how I was feeling. I also wrote about the reasons why I thought I'd started drinking too much. You know, I wrote, so, you know, about what it felt like when I was drinking, all of those sort of, you know, the stupid things that I did. You know, I just got a whole load of stuff off my chest. And then what happened is people started finding this blog, and which ended up sort of going viral and had millions of hits over the first year. And as people started finding it, they started saying, oh, you know, I feel like that too. I used to do that as well. And there's something, you know, I went from feeling incredibly alone to feeling like actually, you know, there was a whole community of people all around the world, just like me. And we were all struggling with the same thing and we all helped each other. And that, you know, they say that the opposite of addiction is connection. And certainly I found that in that I might have easily fallen off the wagon if it was only myself that it was impacting. But I was aware that I'd created this whole community. And if I fell off the wagon, I was worried about what it might do to them. So I think they all kept me going, really.
I guess that's the plot of Iona and Iverson's Rules for Commuting, right? I mean, she's a person who gives help but needs help.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, and I actually hadn't thought about that, but yes, I think often the way we help ourselves is by helping other people. So, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12th step is giving back. And it's, you know, the reason giving back is important isn't just because it helps other people, it's because it helps you, because it reminds you, you know, why you're doing what you're doing, and it gives you a sense of purpose. And, you know, and I think Iona definitely finds that, you know, helping the other people she meets on the train is in the end changes her own life. It transforms her life.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. My guest this week is Claire Pooley. She's a New York Times best-selling author. Her first novel was called The Authenticity Project, and her new book, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting.
So the Sober Diaries, and I haven't read that. That's your first book, How One Woman Stopped Drinking and Started Living. It is an outgrowth of the blog. I mean, is it actually the blog?
It's an edited version of the blog. So it's in diary form, and it's actually the diary of my first year of not drinking. And it's got a whole load of sort of facts and about alcohol addiction and about how to deal with it, sort of woven into the story. So it's and it's been described as Bridget Jones Dries Out, which always makes me laugh because it's funny, you know, it's in a dark way.
Well, because you're very funny and your books are funny. Do you still blog, or you ended the blog?
No, I don't now, mainly partly because I'm busy writing novels. But also, you know, I, to be honest, my kids are now teenagers, and You know, when I started blogging, they were little and they didn't really, you know, they didn't mind me telling their stories. Whereas, you know what teenagers are like about boundaries, So, you know, imagine how upset your teenagers get if you take a photo of them and put it on Facebook. Yeah. And then imagine how they'd feel if you wrote about their life in a blog, which ended up in a book and in a bookshop, you know. So I got to the point where I thought, I can't really do this anymore.
Yeah. And you kept the blog anonymous until you became a published writer?
Yes. And you know what? It was terrifying because, you know, for the two or three nights before the book was published, I remember thinking, you know, is it too late to back out of this? And of course, it was too late because I had national TV and radio and press and everything all organized. And I had this recurring dream that I was sort of walking down the street naked and everyone was staring at me because that's how it felt. It felt like walking out in public without your clothes on. So it was terrifying, but it was the best thing I ever did, you know, and I still get messages from people every day saying that reading that book has changed their lives.
Who were your influences as a writer, and if you have them, and what kind of stuff do you read?
Oh, God. You know what? I read everything. So there's not one particular genre that I read. So I read psychological thrillers. I'll read romance. I'll read classics. It just really depends on my mood. But I love Dickens and Austen, but I also love all the sort of, you know, contemporary much lighter novels. It really, really does depend on how I'm feeling.
I saw some description of your book as being women's literature, which kind of surprised me, you know, because I'm not a woman, but I really enjoyed your book anyway. Do you think of your books as being written for women?
Well, you know what? I did, I guess, at the beginning, because I'm a woman and I thought, well, I like this sort of story, so maybe other women will too. But I've had more emails from men than I have from women. And I'm not sure whether that's just because they're more likely to contact me or whether I have more male readers. I really don't know. But certainly I don't. Yeah, it seems that they appeal as much to men as to women. But, you know, just the term women's literature, I find a bit strange because it's often used in a sort of almost derogatory form. And you sort of think, well, you know, why should women's literature be any less than men's literature? It's a strange thing. I think a good story is a good story, whoever tells it and whoever it's told to.
Yeah. I think the majority of books that are published are dark and have crime in them, and your book is very light, and I mean, even looking at the cover of it is very light. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it, because I mean, I do read psychological thrillers, I read dark stories, but I'm not sure, I don't think I could write them because I have to live with these characters in my head, you know, for a long period of time. And I think if I had to live with those sort of dark characters in my head, I'm not sure what it would do for my mental health.
You
know?
Yeah.
I've always written as a form of therapy, and I like writing the sort of books that make people feel better about the world, not worse about the world. So, particularly at a time like this, you know, it's the Authenticity Project came out in the middle of the pandemic, and you know, and now it's the world is still a troubled place. And, you know, I think, you know, great, great stories can just help transport you away from that for a while.
Do you have a bunch of stories that you want to tell? Will there be a lot of novels?
I hope so. Yes. yes, I do. So, yes, as long as people carry on wanting to read my stories, I'd love to carry on writing them.
And are you writing another one now?
I have. It's in my head. I'm sort of percolating it.
Uh-huh. So do you outline your novels first or not really?
You know what? I'm sort of superstitious. I sort of think if I write too rigid an outline to start off with, that it sets everything in stone too much. So I tend to plan everything out in my head and then see what happens. So I try not to write it down, because then it feels more like it's less malleable.
Do you read your reviews, and not just the professional reviews, but the reviews that people write on Amazon and so on?
Oh, good question. I do, actually. I mean, I don't read all of them, you know, because, I mean, for instance, the Authenticity Project had sort of on Goodreads, there are sort of 50,000 or so reviews. So, you know, you couldn't possibly read them all. But I do. I mean, I sort of, and, you know, I find it hard not to. I do tell myself sometimes I shouldn't look at reviews. But yes, it's hard not to.
Well, it's just a great book, and I can't recommend it highly enough. And I we don't want to say too much about it, because there's just delightful surprises on every page, and everybody should read it. It's called Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting, and the author is my guest, the brilliant Claire Pooley. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it enormously. Thanks a million.
Claire Pooley, the New York Times bestselling author of The Authenticity Project and her new book, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. There's an exhibition I want you to know about at the Minow Arts Gallery in downtown Santa Cruz during the month of July. It features the work of renowned artist Gregory Edwards, and I asked Mr. Edwards to drop by and talk to us about the show. Gregory Edwards, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Now, you work in many mediums, but tell us specifically about this work at the Minow. How did this body of work come to be?
Well, it's mostly out of a sketchbook that I carried with me in my job as a chauffeur. I sort of, back in the early 80s, I was starving to death, and I decided that I would go the route that my father had taken, which was to be a chauffeur. In, I'd say about 95, 96, I started making sketches in a sketchbook. I think it started in Vancouver, British Columbia. My wife was speaking up there and had a broken foot and needed me to rush there to push her around in a wheelchair. And so I had a lot of wait time, and I sat and drew, and it sort of enhanced this idea of serving someone who I really cared about, and also having downtime, having a way to use the downtime to improve my hand. So that it sort of started like that. By, say, 2002, I ordered a new Cadillac. It's an executive sedan. It's stretched 6 inches. It's a custom Cadillac that's made by Cadillac's number one car chassis maker. They will mount a desk on the a rear-facing desk on the passenger seat. So if you're sitting in the right rear passenger well, you can sit and draw. And I did that for the next, I don't know, 20 years, it seems. I'm still doing it. But that particular book is the book from which those drawings were taken. And in fact, you may have seen there was a framed piece on the table where we were sitting, and that is that sketchbook that I just sort of mashed into a frame so that it'd be available for people to see how I spilled a big cup of coffee in the middle of it.
How does the work from the sketchbook become the work that's on the wall in the Minow Arts Gallery?
A guy named Peter Stamfer, a tech guy, was a studio neighbor of mine. And Peter was the guy that asked the best questions, talked sort of the newest ideas, And the other artists did not treat him kindly because he was in his 40s and they're like, you're a tech guy, you're not an artist. As you imagine in Berkeley, a lot of those kinds of questions rage around and people are always pulling one upsmanship on each other. And I always thought the guy had great ideas and I treated him as such. And one day he came to me and said he wanted to print his own works. So he bought the new Epson 40-inch bed printer and he would love to print my work so that he could learn to print his own. Ooh. And I thought that was, you know, a fantastic thing just to have fall in my lap. So I gave him the sketchbook. He went and scanned the my newest drawing. And 3 days later, I had one of those pieces that you saw up on the wall. And that was like, wow, that's incredible. So, you know, we began to collaborate and I made the first group of them. His life changed and he went in a different direction, but I found other master printers. Some not so collaborative in their spirit as others, but then eventually I found one in Los Angeles who was a real master printer and someone who had been doing these kinds of things without necessarily being a part of the arts, but being a Greek national. He'd sort of come out of this whole idea of art and philosophy in the beginning of his pursuit of this area. So we just hit it off right away because that's kind of my bent as well. And he would scan and print these pieces and I just built up a body of them so that one day, you know, whenever somebody was ready for them, I could show them. And it just so happened, this is not the first time they've been shown, but it just so happened that the Minnow Arts people, Christy and Trevor, were interested in showing those works. So so most of them are scanned from the sketchbook. There is an original painting just to sort of give the idea of the connection between free expression on the one hand and execution on the other, which is the works in the sketchbook. So that there's this relationship between the two, but you have to really believe that you're connected. So when I'm in the middle of my execution, I have to, you know, find ways to make sure that that it's a departure from what I've done in the past. So I can't do a drawing today like the drawing I did yesterday, so to speak. And the painting is always just basically splashing paint, but coming up with techniques that bring out some kind of specific aesthetic within the free expression of the day. Because that too comes out of this Zen thing that I saw. The priests would come and sit next to a prepared bed of sand and they would make one mark in the sand. And then at the end of the day or at the end of this session, they would erase that mark and prepare the sand for a new mark tomorrow. And that's kind of the philosophy that I try to pursue when I'm making the painting. So there are both, and there's also an element of photography. I started out as a photographer in the 60s, and so there's one piece in there that's like that. And so the show comes together as the drawings from the limousine, the paintings from my painting practice and sort of pulling together those two elements with the photography of my youth. And actually, my father was a photographer. So it's I'm trying to be traditional. I'm trying to use some ideas that are Afrocentric. I went to, you know, CalArts and Art Institute of San Francisco, so I'm aware of the ideas that, you know, that were being bandied about during the, my tenure in school, and I'm just trying to let all of that coalesce into something that I've never seen before, and that's what you witnessed the other night.
Well, it's a remarkable show, and I want everybody to go see it. It's at the Minow Arts Gallery in downtown Santa Cruz. It's possible that some of my podcast listeners will hear this after the show is over at the Minow Arts Gallery in July. Where else can people see your work, Gregory Edwards?
Well, at the moment, I've got representation in San Francisco at Nancy Toomey Fine Arts, and that's in the Minnesota Street Projects. And also at Band of Vices gallery down in Los Angeles. That's in the West Adams area.
Well, very good. Thank you again for spending some time with us, and I hope we see each other again soon.
I do too. Thanks so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.